This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Every state is traveling its own path when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, the health care bill that President Obama championed and signed into law almost 2 years ago. In some states, it's full speed ahead. They're complying with the law's requirements and even meeting deadlines early. In other states, governors have signed on to a multi-state lawsuit charging the law is unconstitutional, but they're still making preparations should the law prevail. And then there are a handful of states, including New Hampshire, ranked as doing very little to get the plan in place. By 2014, New Hampshire isn't part of the lawsuit, but planning grants for what are called exchanges, marketplaces where people can comparison shop for health coverage, have been rejected by the Executive Council, the New Hampshire House, and most recently, the State Senate. The dominant argument at our State House is the Affordable Care Act will be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court or repealed by the next president, so there's no point in spending taxpayer dollars getting ready for it. Today in The Exchange, we take the temperature of the health care law in the Granite State and how that fits into a mixed national picture. And let's hear from you, too. Have you felt the first impacts of the Affordable Care Act? Have they been positive? Do you feel this is the right way to go? Or have you been frustrated by the law and concerned about its cost and complexity? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email. The address, exchange@nhpr.org. We had three guests for the hour. With me in studio, Lisa Kaplan Howe, Policy Director for New Hampshire Voices for Health, a nonprofit consumer advocacy organization. And Lisa, nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Charlie Arlinghouse, President of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, a free market think tank based in Concord. And Charlie, good morning. Good to see you.
Thanks.
And joining us from D.C. is Marilyn Serafini. She's the Robin Toner Distinguished Fellow and a special correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And Marilyn, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, and Marilyn, I want to get the national picture from you first, if we could. One writer said the country is a patchwork nation when it comes to this law, meaning every state is in a different place in terms of implementation and feelings about it. What do you see? Are we a patchwork nation, Marilyn?
Oh, we're definitely a patchwork nation. But that said, all states are facing big challenges this year. The major provisions in the law don't kick in until 2014 because that's when most people will be required to buy health insurance, and the system could be adding an estimated 32 million people, either in Medicaid or in private insurance. So to get those people into the system, states are supposed to be creating exchanges, health insurance exchanges. So that's where we start to become this big patchwork nation. So even though the changes don't take place, the big changes till 2014, this is the year for changes. This is the year that states really have to get down to business because there's a very important deadline on January 1st of 2013, and that is when the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services will certify states to become exchanges. So at that time, Health and Human Services is going to decide which states are ready to have their own exchanges. And if they're not, then the federal government has to get ready to come in and take over and run an exchange for a state. What we have, and this is the patchwork you're referring to, we only have at this point 13 states or so that have actually moved forward and are in the process of creating their own exchanges, or they've already done it. Another half a dozen or so have signaled their intent to create their own exchanges. Another half a dozen have said, absolutely not, we're not going to do this. We're going to wait and see what the Supreme Court has to say. If they overturn the law, there's no reason to move forward. But then that leaves an enormous number of states, just about half the states in the middle, figuring out what to do. Do we want to wait? Do we want to move forward? And this is a big question for the states, because if they even some states that have signed on to the Supreme Court case to try and overturn the law, some of them are still moving forward with exchanges. And that's because they figure, well, if it does happen, if this whole thing moves forward, we don't want the federal government coming into our state and running exchanges. But there are mixed views.
Well, and this has been the debate certainly here in New Hampshire. Do you just say no, no way? Or do you say, okay, I don't like this law, but in case it prevails, let's get ready. So it seems like Maryland, correct me if I'm wrong, states that are controlled by Democrats, full speed ahead, those controlled by Republicans, tending to hold back, as you said, hoping the law will be wiped out by the Supreme Court or maybe a new Republican president. Then there are these middle ground states, those that you said are part of the lawsuit, but at the same time getting ready for the law just in case. What's the dynamic in those states, Marilyn? I think that's really interesting.
Well, it's a very difficult question, especially for the Republican states, because, you know, here they don't want the law, they don't want it to happen, but they're also worried to death that if the law does happen, that they're going to get stuck with the federal government in their state. So ideologically speaking, it's a very difficult situation for them. That's why you have states like Colorado, Washington, Nevada, who are on the lawsuit. Yet those are three states who have already put exchanges into place.
Charlie Arlinghouse, love your thoughts. Where you see New Hampshire in terms of this law, and especially this issue of exchanges that Marilyn's talking about?
Well, I think there are a variety of opinions about it, about exchanges, and part of the problem is that I think they're woefully misunderstood, and there's this notion that we have to have an exchange or the federal government will have an exchange here, as if those are two different things. And in reality, they aren't two different things. If the federal government has an exchange, they run the rules and regulations and administer and pay for them. If the state government has an exchange, the federal government still runs the rules and regulations. It just has local agents with a local address that pretend like they're running everything. But in reality, they're merely a puppet government. Napoleon still makes all the rules, but we get our own king. It's not really any different. And I think increasingly people look at that and they say, the Heritage Foundation is a good example. The Heritage Foundation helped set up the exchange in Massachusetts, the pre-Obamacare exchange, which is called a connector in Massachusetts. And they looked at it at the time and said, oh, this might be a good thing. They looked at exchanges now, and their initial response to the law is, we don't like the law. We didn't support Obamacare or the ACA. But maybe states should set up an exchange.
Because it's a market-based comparison shop, almost like Travelocity, where you can go on and search around.
It's like more like ehealthinsurance.com, which some people would argue is sort of already an exchange. But they looked at it and said there's no fundamental difference between whether you run the exchange yourself or HHS runs the exchange for you. And because of that, we encourage states to not set up an exchange. Now, I don't want to overstate this. There are some differences, but no substantive ones. All of the real decisions are made in Washington, and all of the real mandates come from Washington, and we have to administer them. So if it's all the same, why don't we do it? Because then we'd have to pay for it. And the big question is, the Massachusetts exchange costs $29 million. It probably has to have more regulation to adhere to the new law, and our exchange wouldn't cost as much as Massachusetts. But what would it cost? I don't know, 10 to 20 million in that range a year, and the feds would help set it up, and the startup would be paid for by federally collected tax dollars. But after that, we're on our own, and we have to pay for it. And I think that what's going to prevail here, and I think this is the conventional wisdom, is that at least one or the other house of the legislature is going to say, you know what? That's a lot of money. And if there's no real difference, no major substantive difference, we're not going to do it.
Well, Lisa, as you well know, this was a heated debate in the state Senate just recently. Some people saying what Charlie says, other people saying, no, no, let's set it up ourselves, including the Business and Industry Association, which said, look, like the law or don't like the law, you know, let's put our own stamp on this. What do you think about Charlie's point, though, regardless of whether New Hampshire goes for it or not, the federal government is going to have the final say over what this exchange looks like.
You know, I think that that's a concern and a thought that a lot of people had really leading up to federal regulations being released in the summer, and they have to be finalized still. But what we saw and what people across the country saw when those regulations came out is that it set out the broad structure, but there was an incredible amount of flexibility provided to states. So you have insurance commissioners like the conservative insurance commissioner in Kansas, who's by no way a fan of the law, saying, wow, this is really great. We can create our own exchange and really make a lot of choices. And that will allow the state to decide, do we want something really large like Massachusetts has? Or we can have something much smaller, much more similar to the Utah exchange, which my understanding is costs $600,000 a year. And I think the point with that also to keep in mind is that whether it's a state-based exchange or a federally facilitated exchange, it doesn't need to be state-funded. It needs to be self-sustaining. And so that doesn't mean that the money is coming from the state or from the state's general fund. It means that the exchange needs to find a source of revenue to sustain itself. So I think the reason that you're seeing a lot of people like the BIA and like insurance companies and like brokers and providers and conservative legislators like Senator White say we need to move forward is similar to the dynamic you're seeing in other states of we need to maintain local control so we can make sure that the regulatory and our authority that exists in our state remains, and also so that we can control the size and the impact of the exchange.
Well, in Maryland, again, with Kaiser Health News, I love your thoughts, given that we looked at this nationally, on what we're doing here in New Hampshire.
Right. You know, before I do that, I want to make one more point because, you know, we've talked about do we do a state exchange? Do we do a federal exchange? But the truth is most of these states are going to end up with something that's in the middle, some kind of a hybrid, a partnership. And the federal government, as it was looking ahead and seeing the very, very short timeline this year, has already come out and said, look, on January 1st, if you're not quite ready for a state exchange, we will allow a continuation. We'll let you continue to work. We think you're moving in the right direction. We're gonna give you something short of a certification that's going to allow you to create, continue to have discussions and create some kind of a partnership. And it's worth noting that the timeline really is very difficult this year. States have got to do this by January 1st, or at least make some very significant progress by January 1st. But most state legislative sessions are very short this year, March or April.
Well, we go until June, so maybe that's a slight advantage. And we'll talk more about that timeline. Very important point that Marilyn raises coming up. We'll also take your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Keep it right here.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEP Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And Holly Oil, a full-service oil company, keeping New Hampshire families warm since 1961, delivering bioheat to customers throughout Manchester and Concord. Holly Oil, HALLEOIL.com. More on assessing the Affordable Care Act on the exchange on NHPR and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, Doctor-Patient Communication in the Digital Age. New Hampshire weather for today, becoming partly to mostly sunny across most of the state, highs 45 to 50, staying mostly cloudy in the North Country with highs there from 35 to 40. Tonight, clear and chilly, lows from near 20 north, ranging to around 30 in the south. And tomorrow, partly sunny with highs from 25 in the North Country, ranging to around 40 in southern New Hampshire. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a two-year check-in on President Obama's Affordable Care Act. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you go to our page, join the conversation there. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to the phones. And Tom is joining us, calling in from Washington, D.C. Hi, Tom. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I'm Tom Weldon. I'm the president of the New Hampshire Health Association of Health Underwriters, and I'm down in Washington at a Capitol conference learning more about what's going on. But there's a lot of misstatements that have been made. I've been reading the testimony that went on last week by both the Representative O'Brien, the speaker, and also by Charlie. And there's several things I need to correct in there. We need to pay for the exchange. We will pay for the exchange either way. If it's a state exchange or if it's a federal exchange, the state of New Hampshire is going to pay for it after the first year. and there's not going to be a difference there. The difference will be if we shape our own exchange, we can narrow the exchange, and it'll be less expensive to state in New Hampshire. The second thing is that the federal supersedes any kind of state laws. So even though they can pass a law to say we can't have an individual mandate, the federal law supersedes that. So because it's the law of the land now, until either the Supreme Court rules or it's overruled by some other legislation, that is what the law is, that we need to follow these things. And another part that O'Brien spoke to was about that the federal government would control the doctors, and that's not correct at all. Charlie spoke to a couple things about Medicare not being reduced, and Medicaid not being reduced, whether or not we had a state exchange or a federal exchange. And in fact, Medicaid is targeted to be reduced to the states over a time period, regardless if it's a state or federal exchange. And the last point that Charlie made was regarding the premium subsidies, that if it was a state exchange versus a federal exchange, the state would not get any kind of subsidies. It's actually, the first thoughts were the reverse of that. I mean, this is very technical, I understand.
Yeah,
I apologize
Tom, can I just
that,
jump in for a second? And maybe we should talk to you once you get back to New Hampshire. But, and I'm glad you called, President of the New Hampshire Association of Health Underwriters. I'd love to get your broad thoughts, though, given your position. How do you feel about this law overall? Is it a good thing for our healthcare sector or not?
The first part of the law is good because the name of the law is, Patient Protection and Affordable Health Care Act. They did okay on the patient protection side in terms of the preventative care, the unlimited amounts of coverage in covering children age 26 on a federal basis. So those things were good. The affordability doesn't exist. I had dinner last night with Representative Ginta, and he voted in support of repeal of the bill in the House. But he also supports 163 to set up an exchange because he knows that if we don't limit the size and the scope of the exchange, it's going to be much larger, much broader under the federal government, and we still will pay for it as a state. We just won't have control. Our Department of Insurance, or HHS, in New Hampshire will have much less control over what's done because the federal government will be setting it up.
Okay, thanks a lot for joining us. And lots of specific points, but real broadly, I think to you, Charlie, his broad point is that, look, we're going to pay for these exchanges either way, so let's shape it ourselves and keep the scope narrower.
His broad point was that what I said at a hearing this week was inaccurate, and that's inaccurate. There was no sentence that I uttered at the hearing that was remotely inaccurate, not defensible, and not footnotable, and I resent the implication. But other than that, I appreciate his call and would like to respond to a couple of things. First of all, no one is suggesting that the state has the authority to repeal the individual mandate in the law. It is the worst part of the law. It's something that we want to get rid of. It's something the Supreme Court's going to weigh in on.
That's the basis of the multi-state
neither,
lawsuit, right?
Yeah, and that's neither here nor there. The notion that this will be less expensive because we administer it than if the federal government administers it, it seems to me flies in the face of human nature. The federal government is going to impose the regulations that we have to administer. And it seems to me that if we're paying the bill for the regulations, there's going to be less of a break on them. And they're less concerned about the cost of those regulations if we're administering them and if we're paying for them. If they are paying for them, they also have to raise the money to pay for them. And the law does not include money to pay for federal exchanges. It's one of the reasons the administration is so intent on states establishing exchanges and that they keep moving the deadline back because they want every state to have an exchange because they don't have the money to pay for the exchange. They're the federal government, so they can print more money. That's easier for them. But the notion that we can pay for it, whether it's self-sustaining or whatever, it is true that the state legislation says the insurance commissioner can raise the money however he sees fit. And he has to tell us how he raises it. But essentially, he can impose whatever fees, taxes, et cetera, essentially on the industry, which are then passed through to us, that he sees fit. And that's a question. That we could administer some sort of Utah-style exchange, it's just silly. The Utah Exchange is not federally compliant. The Utah Exchange is nothing more than essentially ehealthinsurance.com. It is a price shopping mechanism. It does not meet any of the federal regulations whatsoever. And this was something the Heritage Foundation started out as their position was we can establish an exchange and we can look at it. And one of the things they discovered, and these are people who supported the Massachusetts law, let's keep that in mind, they decided there is no fundamental difference because of the regulatory capacity in a state exchange and a federal exchange. So the state should not establish one.
Tom raised two other broad questions that I do want to address. And Tom, thanks again for calling in. Marilyn, here's this one for you. He said, look, federal law supersedes state desires. It's the law of the land. What kind of precedent is there for the federal government to pass a law and then about half of the states say, nah, we don't want to do this?
I can't say what kind of precedent there is. I really can't. In my time of covering, I've been covering Congress since 1985. I can't think of another time where something like this has happened. You have a situation here where it really doesn't matter, because we're going to know something. The Supreme Court is going to decide this. If the Supreme Court upholds the law, then there's still another question. The question is, what's going to happen in the 2012 election if we have a Republican president, if the House continues as a Republican majority, if the Senate continues as a Republican majority? Of course, it would need a supermajority of 60 votes to be able to really kill the law. And even if the law were killed at that point, the question is, how much of the law would be killed? Would you just kill the individual mandate? Could they kill the whole thing? It's really rather unlikely, especially given that there are so many provisions already in place that have been implemented over the last 2 years that really have proven fairly popular.
So what pieces remain if you repeal? Is that what you're saying, Marilyn?
And that's the question. There really is no answer to that question, because it would depend on what the president, the legislators, would try to pull out of the bill at that point. I think most people believe that you're not going to get rid of the law entirely. And that's why we have states struggling with this question about how to proceed, because they feel that even if the law disappears, what will still be left of it? There'll still be something lingering. And it's too unclear for them to know how to proceed.
Well, and here's one more point that Tom raised, and this is for you, Lisa Kaplan Howe. He said he likes what the law does in terms of patient protection. In other words, you can't deny people coverage based on existing conditions, children with health issues and so forth. He said on the affordable end, it has not done a good job. There was a New York Times piece that ran just recently by an analyst called Ezekiel Emanuel. He said the act will not do much to ease the strain on state budgets. An estimated 21.8 million more adults and children will be covered by Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program. That's the expansion of coverage. While states will be responsible for only a small portion of these new enrollees, there will be added costs, and states will no longer be able to restrict eligibility to save money. He concludes by saying, liberals are wrong to ignore costs. The more we spend on health care, the less we spend on other things we value, like education and so forth. What about that? Are backers of this law ignoring the very important issues of cost?
I don't think anybody's ignoring costs. I think there's costs at two levels. There's costs to the state, and there's certainly costs that we all incur currently as healthcare costs increase. And those are both very important. But I think what gets lost in this debate, and what gets lost in the debate we've just had over the last 20, 30 minutes, is how it's impacting people already. The law is impacting people already. And there's a lot of back and forth, and there are certainly a lot of things that Tom said that I agree with and Charlie said that I disagree with, and I think we could go back and forth for a long time. But I think the shame is that then we lose sight of how people are benefiting. And, we have over 200,000 people in our state on Medicare who now have improved access to preventive care and to prescription drugs. We have children, as you mentioned, over 16,000 in our state, whose families now for the first time can buy them health insurance because they're sick and they were never allowed to buy it before. That's good for them to be able to contribute to society. It's also good for the rest of us. It's good for our public health, and it's certainly good for our health care costs, because if they can't buy insurance, they're still going to need health care. It doesn't make them immune from the need for health care. They go to the hospital. They need services. They're astronomically expensive. And at the end of the day, the costs get shifted to the rest of us and raises our health insurance premiums. So I think the point that Marilyn makes is very important, that we need to take a look at what's working in the law and make sure that people continue benefiting. And we also need to take a look at what might not be working and improve it, but not just go back to a system that wasn't working in the first place.
Well, and Charlie, real quick to you, how concerned are you at the Josiah Bartlett Center about this creating another huge budgetary need in New Hampshire state budget?
I think it's unclear yet the extent to which it will impact the budget. And there are questions, obviously, there are questions about the cost of an exchange, which I discussed, but there are real questions about the cost of Medicaid for a couple of different reasons. One is additional people covered. who the federal government is going to cover for a while. But there are additional efforts about enrollment that will lead to an additional increase in Medicaid coverage that is going to be a significant strain on the budget. But I don't know that it's clear yet exactly how that's going to be implemented and how that's going to happen. And it's too early to say. In any law like this, there are winners and losers. And there's no question that there are going to be some people who are going to benefit from this. But one of the economists who helped design both the Massachusetts system and the federal system, which are similar in a number of ways, although that's a whole political issue, but they're similar in a number of ways, has said that probably 80% of the people will see their costs increase by something like 40%, and which means that there are about 20% of the people who won't see their costs increase, and that's a great law for them, and it's not a great law for 80%. But I think on balance, it's probably not a good law, and it's probably not going to accomplish what it thinks it's going to accomplish, and we know that because it didn't work in Massachusetts.
Well, some people say it worked in Massachusetts because so many people are covered, but that the cost part was a continuing concern. That seems to be the final analysis.
The costs were sort of exponentially higher than were predicted, and I think that's unlikely to be any different in a law that's not really any different.
There's so many callers. Yeah, Marilyn, go ahead. I want to go back to them, but go ahead, Marilyn.
You know, we're talking about cost, and I think it's important. I think we're all talking about cost with a different definition of cost. There's the cost to the individual, there's the cost to the government, there's the cost to the healthcare system in general. But Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, just about everybody believes that the law did not do as much as it could have to lower the overall cost of healthcare, and that would benefit everybody to lower the cost of healthcare. The Obama administration has said repeatedly that there are provisions in the law to lower costs. Many people are a little bit uneasy with that statement because most of what's in the law that could potentially lower costs come in the way of demonstration projects, for instance, accountable care organizations, better coordinating care. But those things take time, and they are small little programs that will hopefully demonstrate whether these kinds of systems will lower costs. But really, we may not see the effects for a while.
Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, it's a check-in 2 years after the health care law was passed. We're looking at where the states are in terms of putting this law in place. Also, given that there is this multi-state lawsuit pending before the U.S. Supreme Court and the presidential election with the Republican candidates promising to repeal the health care law. By the way, all of you, we received a call from someone who said, don't call it Obamacare. The official name is the Affordable Care Act, so the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act. So I just want to put that out there that we did get that comment. And let's go to Hillary calling in from Charleston. Hi, Hillary. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Hi, my name is Hillary St. Pierre, and I'm calling coming from a couple of different viewpoints. I'm actually a registered nurse that specializes in both emergency department care and critical care, though I see this issue most frequently with my critical care patients, and also I am a Hodgkin lymphoma patient myself who's undergone treatment for the past 7 years. I was diagnosed at 23, and now I'm 29. So,
well, that's tough, Hillary. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, it's given me an interesting viewpoint because I've been able to see the entire law from start to finish as a professional and then as a patient. And what I'm wondering is if the federal courts do overturn the law in whatever capacity, what do patients expect to happen that are currently receiving the benefits of the law? Because there are some very good provisions, such as personally I've benefited from the removal of the cap. Insurances could cap your health care benefits at $2 million. Which would have given me a year and a half of treatment, and I was not capped, so I was able to continue with standard treatment.
So Yeah, Hillary, I hear you. What happens, your question, what happens to those patient protection provisions of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act if the law is overturned? Marilyn Serafini, I don't think we really know, do we?
Well, we can't say for sure. There's no way to say for sure. What we do know, however, is that even Republican presidential candidates, not all of them, but there have been a few who have come up and said, look, yeah, I hate this law, and they do call it Obamacare. We need to get rid of it. But even some of them have said, but we need to keep the insurance provisions. We can't go back to pre-existing conditions. We can't go back to the kind of system we had before where there was a risk selection, you know, cherry picking the best people who have the least risk. So we do know that. However, if that were to happen, I think there would be a huge outcry from the insurance industry because, if you recall, there was a deal made toward the very beginning of the health reform debate, where the insurance industry said, "Okay, yes, we agree. We will stop with the pre-existing conditions. We'll take just about everybody, and we'll limit the cost range for plans for policies. But at the same time, you have to guarantee." That we will have just about everybody in the system. Because if you don't have just about everybody in the system, then you're going to have people waiting until they get sick to apply for coverage.
What about that question, Charlie? Hillary, our nurse and cancer patient, wants to know, hey, if this law is overturned, what about those patient protection provisions?
I think a lot of those provisions would stay, although not necessarily all of them. There are a number of ways to address adverse selection issues with regard to, the notion is that you don't want someone to go along through life without any insurance whatsoever, and then when they break their leg, they get insurance. They get their leg covered, they go back off insurance, because then it's not insurance.
Right.
But by the same token, you want to worry about pre-existing conditions, and there are other ways to do that. I think that's you would find issues like that, and pre-existing conditions are an issue, and how you deal with things like insurance caps and high risk pools and all of that are areas where people would come together and find a solution, because those are sort of the most obvious things to tackle. Without necessarily having to do it in an extraordinarily comprehensive or intrusive, depending on your perspective, law.
All right.
Which I'll start calling PPACA instead of Obamacare.
PPACA is Patient Protection Affordable Care Act. And Hillary, good luck to you with your cancer treatments, and thanks for calling in. We'll take more of your calls after a short break, 1-800-892-6477. The Exchange is on Facebook. You can go to our page and continue the conversation there, or send us an email right now, exchange@nhpr.org.
Today on Word of Mouth, the constitutionality of space cooperation. We'll hear about a federal law blocking the White House initiative to work with China on future space missions. And it's Oscar nomination day. We'll highlight the must-see movies and get the scoop on Hollywood snubs. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth reveals who we're wearing today at noon and again at 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Grupponi Auto Group, featuring multiple lines of fuel-efficient, environmentally friendly cars at Grupponi Auto Junction in Bow, and online 24 hours a day at grupponi.com. And Upton and Hatfield, committed to being the Granite State's law firm, serving New Hampshire businesses, municipalities, and individuals for over 100 years. UptonHatfield.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, reactions to President Obama's State of the Union address tonight. Email us your thoughts if you watch the speech to exchange@nhpr.org, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at the development of President Obama's health care law and pushback against that law throughout the country. Join us with your questions and comments. Call in 1-800-892-6477 or email us exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests: Charlie Arlinghouse, president, the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy, Lisa Kaplan Howe, policy director for New Hampshire Voices for Health, and then giving us a national picture is Marilyn Serafini. She's a special correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And all of you, let's go back to the calls. And Tom is joining us from Concord. Tom, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. And just let me, in the spirit of transparency, just let me. I'm Tom Raffio. I'm CEO of Northeast Delta Dental. So obviously, I'm in the insurance industry and have skin in the game. So I just want to be transparent on that. I just want to make a couple points. As far as the overall federal law, there were certain parts of it, you know, covering kids, age 26. Of course, New Hampshire already had that. And some of the points, you know, eliminating pre-existing conditions. We're all in favor of that. In fact, most consumers in the country are in favor of that, which is why this makes it a difficult proposition for certain politicians, because there are definitely aspects of the federal law that people like. My point from a business perspective, though, is businesses can deal with anything as long as there's certainty. And if we defer to the federal government, we just don't know as an insurance industry and as businesses what is going on. So, you know, like it or not, the Affordable Care Act is here, and we just simply need to address it. There are a couple points I just want to clarify. Charlie had mentioned that there's maybe no difference, but one key difference is that the federal government recently told the states that if you control your own exchange, that the state may determine what is the essential health benefits to be offered on the exchange. So we'll be able to better control that. And there's another fine-tune point that I want to make, in that in the Affordable Care Act, if we defer to the federal government, a lot of the current routine functions by our own local departments of insurance, like the approval of rates and policy forms and customer assistance, we control that if we have our own state exchange. If we don't, then the federal government will do that. So that will be counter to, I think we have a great Department of Insurance, and we don't want to defer that to the federal government.
Tom, can I ask you a quick question here?
Sure.
And it's not on the exchanges, because we talked a lot about that, and I will give Charlie a quick chance to jump in. But you said something that caught my attention. You said, from a business perspective, we like certainty. But it's uncertain, as you well know, what's going to happen with this law. We might have a Republican president who will repeal it. We might have the Supreme Court, which might overturn it. So from that business perspective, what do you do about that? Do you go ahead? Do you, wait? What do you do?
Well, we've made all the we're starting to make all the technology investments. I'm working 7 days a week, 24/7, to make it happen. We hired a full-time attorney, you know, to Christine Albrandi to interpret all the laws. We're actually Northeast Delta Dental is also Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. Each one of those, our sister states in Maine and Vermont, are doing different things. So we're preparing for the reality of the Affordable Care Act, because even if a Republican becomes president, even if the Supreme Court makes a decision, as one of the speakers mentioned, it's going to be a narrow decision. It may, you know, outlaw the mandate for insurance, but the genie's out of the bottle. The exchanges are here, and as I said, most citizens in the country like a lot of the aspects of the Affordable Care. Now, it's definitely not lowered costs, because I'm looking at me as a regional dental insurance company, and we're spending thousands of dollars on consultants, and we hired a lawyer and all
complying.
The technology.
Tom, I'm going to let you go. It's great to hear from you, given, again, as you said, that you got skin in the game. And, boy, lots of points there. Charlie Arlinghouse, going back to that issue of the exchanges and whether they should be state-created or federally created.
Well, the notion of certainty or uncertainty is obviously a big question. And I would just argue that the state doesn't get to make the rules. The state gets to implement the rules that the federal government makes. So it's not like it doesn't seem to me that you have greater certainty when you have an additional layer of bureaucracy. It's not like the state tells you what to do. The feds tell the state what to do, and then the state tells you what to do. Or the feds tell you what to do. And I'm not sure one of those is necessarily better than the other. And it's worth noting that we can revisit the notion of having a state exchange anytime, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 6 years down the road.
Okay, Lisa, you look like you want to jump in, and then Marilyn, I have another question for you.
Sure, and I know we've talked a lot about exchanges. I guess the way I would look at it, and the way if you look at the regs, I think you'll see this, that the state gets options to make. And so there really is a lot of choices that a state can make. And I think, you know, if we get a federal exchange, it's going to be one model that we get. If the state has the option, there are many different choices they can make. And that's why we're going to see a range of exchanges across the country. And granted, staters will be able to make sure that our exchange meets our unique needs, because the needs of people in New Hampshire are vastly different than the needs of people across the country.
You know, he raised another interesting point. And Marilyn, I'll throw this to you. He said, you know, the Supreme Court might not overturn this whole thing. It might just overturn that individual mandate that everybody carry health insurance. Is anybody talking about that in D.C., that this might not be a whole overhaul, but a partial rejection?
You know, again, nobody really knows for sure which parts are going, which parts are staying. If they overturn the mandate, it's possible that's all will go, and that we'll still see all of these benefits and all of the other requirements. We could still see exchanges. We could even see something. I've heard recently discussion about not mandating that people purchase insurance, but penalizing them if they do not. So, you know, already in Medicare, we have a precedent for in the prescription drug program, the Part D program, where there is, you know, there is penalty in certain parts of Medicare, where if you make a certain choice and then you make a different choice and you go back to regular insurance, you do pay some kind of a penalty. So I've started to hear a little bit of discussion of, you know, what you do after a mandate is gone. Is there some other way to continue to strongly encourage people to get insurance?
Here's another question, again, coming out of what Tom raised. He talked about businesses facing uncertainty. He talked about the costs of compliance at his company, Delta Dental. I want to ask you about the impact on the private sector a little bit more. We've talked about the impact on individuals. We talked about the budgetary impact on states. Here's an article that was published in Forbes by someone at the Galen Institute, which is a free market think tank based in the D.C. suburbs. The author is Grace Marie Turner. She reports that health insurers are dropping out of markets in many states, causing millions of people to lose the coverage they have now, and tens of millions, she says, will surely follow. The reason, she says, plans give is they are suffering under a mountain of regulations and choking them with impossible cost tests. Those are her words. What do you hear about that, Marilyn? Are private insurers dropping coverage in states around the country because of these costs and regulations?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how much that is happening, but I will tell you that there is a whole lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen. You know, the folks I was speaking with, the folks at the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association here not too long ago, and they are really under the gun because they can't do much until the states do what they need to do. So, for example, if you have states that may not get their work done on exchanges until the ends of their legislative sessions or until after the Supreme Court rules, or maybe they don't even do it by the end of this year. Well, the insurance companies still have to start preparing plans. They have to renegotiate all their contracts with physicians, with hospitals, with other medical providers. There is a lot going on that they have to do, and there's a lot of uncertainty. At the same time, you have Medicare, which is changing and has already changed. You know, currently, 3/4 of Medicare beneficiaries still get their service through the traditional fee-for-service program, but 1/4 of Medicare beneficiaries get their care through the Medicare Advantage program, which is private insurance. More often than not, it's a PPO or an HMO. And these plans are going to be paid less because of the health care law, and are already starting to be paid less because of the health care law than they have been paid, so that the payments are more equivalent to what we've seen for payments for seniors in the fee-for-service program. So have we seen a few plans exit because of that? Yes, we have. So we are seeing some plans drop out. I really don't know whether how much of a problem this is.
Well, and again, this is an article in Forbes, and here is what it says about Cigna. It says Cigna announced that it's no longer offering health insurance coverage to small businesses in 16 states, including New Hampshire. Charlie Arlinghouse, what do you think about this? How's the private insurance market going to respond to the costs and mandates of this law?
Well, and anytime you have a anytime you have a lot of regulation, particularly significant regulation, smaller providers are going to lose out, and larger providers don't mind that. General Motors, for example, really likes regulation because they've got an entire building with five floors of lawyers, and they can pass that cost on to, you know, 3 million automobiles instead of smaller companies that could only pass it on to a few. So large companies like big regulation, small companies don't. So we would certainly see a consolidation of insurers. We saw that in New Hampshire over the last 15 years when we increased our regulation and the number of insurance companies dramatically declined. The uncertainty of the federal law is an issue, and the uncertainty of the lawsuit is an issue. Because I think what most people think are is that something's probably going to get knocked down, probably the individual mandate, maybe other parts of it.
This is the court case you're talking about.
The court case, but not the whole thing. When that happens, though, it's not like what's left standing is going to be fine. Different parts of the law are based on the individual mandate is needed to make other parts of the law work. And so what will happen is the law will have to be reopened.
And let me just clarify that. You say the individual mandate has to be there to make other parts work because if everybody is covered, there's a big enough pool of money, Charlie, to cover all the other parts? Is that?
Well, the theory is, I mean, when there were intense negotiations with various groups, the pharma industry, the insurance industry, et cetera, and in most of those negotiations, people went, look, I hate this, but I'll accept it if you do this. And if you take away the one of the things, that industry is going to say, hey, that's a bait and switch on us. I mean, yeah, we can do that, but only if you do that. And so once you take away half the deal has to be renegotiated.
Interesting.
And so the law will change no matter what. I mean, the court case is going to get rid of something, and the law is going to change.
Well, so 2 points there. One, real quickly, Lisa, your thoughts about the concern that some insurers are already dropping out because they just don't want to deal with this thing.
And I haven't heard of any of that in New Hampshire, but what you have seen is a lot of our local insurers, like Northeast Delta Dental, but we also have local health insurers like Harvard Pilgrim, who are coming in and really urging the state to move forward and to maintain local control to protect our local insurers. And so I think that's part of the dynamic that's playing out with the exchange, but with other reforms as well, making sure that our state is making the decisions and maintaining control. And I think, you know, both Charlie and Marilyn have said, if the law isn't fully upheld, and many of us think there are strong indications that it will be fully upheld, but if it's not, it's probably just going to be part of it that's overturned. And what we would hope is that the law could be reopened and that people would take a look at what is benefiting people and the benefits people are getting so that those aren't taken away, so that we look for other tools. Because Charlie's right, there are other tools out there to make sure that if the mandate goes away, there are other ways to maintain those consumer protections and other benefits people are getting.
So even if that big pool of money that you get from the mandate is gone, there are other ways to get to the same goal? Is that what you're saying, Lisa?
Well, the mandate makes sure that everybody takes personal responsibility and gets into the health insurance system. So it's not really so much about money, but making sure that people are in the system overall and not just when they need care. So there are other tools to make sure people are in the system in the long run, because that is, like Charlie said, the point of insurance. And that will make the system work better for everyone, because otherwise those of us that choose to buy insurance are footing part of the bill for people who don't choose to buy insurance but can't avoid health care.
Did you want to jump in there, Charlie?
Well, it is about money, though. The reason we want everyone to buy insurance is because the people who are going to be forced to buy insurance who can afford it and won't be subsidized are all young, healthy people. They're going to pay premiums that are going to be significantly higher, and they're not going to consume any health care whatsoever. So it's all cash. I mean, that's the reason everybody wants that, is you want every person in your insurance pool to be 24 because they don't ever use health insurance. And so this is why the insurance companies want all the young people in the pool, because they're like, okay, we can bear costs as long as you got these people coughing up to pay for it. And the people, there's a reason they don't buy insurance, because they know they're not going to consume any. And it's really expensive because under our system in general, you subsidize. You generationally subsidize.
Wow. Lisa, and then to Marilyn. Yeah.
Sure. I don't think that anybody wants people to buy into the system and not use health care. Part of the point of being in the health care system is to get preventive care, to get screenings and to get immunizations and to get care that will prevent longer term needs and more expensive needs down the road.
All right. Well, we've talked about the Supreme Court and the Republican presidential election and the states and their various patchwork of starting to implement this law. Marilyn, what about President Obama? He's got his State of the Union speech tonight. Is he going to say anything about health care?
I think there has to be some discussion about health care. Will there be a lot? I'm not so sure. You know, we tend to get into more health care discussion after we hit the general election. In a Republican primary, we've had more than we usually get this time around. But there should be some health care discussion. The question is how much and what exactly he'll talk about.
And then again, to update us on the Supreme Court, Maryland, they're going to hear the arguments in March, right? And then they usually issue their decisions in June.
That's correct.
All right. Yep. Maryland, go ahead.
Yeah, so we should have some idea. We should have a pretty darn good idea of what's going to happen as we get into the summer. However, again, big time restraints there by the summer. Is it really too late for the states to set up an exchange? It may very well be.
All right. All of you, final thoughts, Charlie Ellinghaus, on where New Hampshire is going to fit into this whole muddled picture that we're looking at?
I think whether people think we should or shouldn't adopt an exchange, we're not going to this year. And some people may think that's a shame. Some people, like me, may think it's a good thing. But we're not going to be one of the states that adopts one. And I don't think that's a crisis.
With that January 1st, 2013 deadline. Lisa, final thoughts from you.
And I think the good news for families and small businesses is even if New Hampshire doesn't adopt a state-based exchange, we will get a federally facilitated exchange that brings the same benefits of transparency and competition and choice that people really need right now.
All right. Well, again, we mentioned President Obama's speech. We'll be carrying that speech live at 9 tonight, and we'll talk about it tomorrow on The Exchange as well. Lisa Kaplan-Howe, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Kaplan-Howe, Policy Director for New Hampshire Voices for Health. Charlie Arlinghaus, thank you as always.
Thanks.
Charlie Arlinghaus, President of the Josiah Bartlett Center for Public Policy. And from D.C., Marilyn Serafini, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you.
Marilyn Serafini, Distinguished Fellow and Special Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. We hope you'll join our page to continue the conversation and learn more about what we're doing every day here on The Exchange. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.